This is why I asked that we have the X-ray where we have camera, so that people can actually see and look at the patient and see how the candidates are responding. And then the names have been ATC, and we've asked for half a million that people may comment, and it takes that and wait to be comment, so that whatever we are coming up with here, we take into cognizance what has happened to the patient. So as we are doing the interview, we will be receiving the comments from the public, so that at the end of the day, we can come up with our recommendations that are going to be sent.
Thank you.
think with the introduction that I'm going to have, I can take the first question and the second question going with the introduction that we're going to have. Because we want to avoid a situation where we all ask the same question. Ulan, the system is nice.
Oh, where is this?
No, Chair.
Okay.
It's a standing apology from the state.
Okay. Can we bring in the
I'm a member of the committee.
we are now going to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself. And this opportunity, is given to you to sell yourself to us as a Catholic community. You tell us who you are, where you are from, and you tell us your interest in languages so that we get a full picture of who you are. Each and every country is going to speak in 5 minutes. You can use all, you can use less. And no matter what language you're using, it's 45 minutes. And you have chosen to interview in English. So we are fine. We will give you an opportunity. You can take 5 minutes to introduce yourself and tell us so that as a Catholic community, we begin this journey of the interview. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, welcome to the community. My name is David Wamashalema, from the Bobo province, but I like thinking of myself as someone from many places because I have the opportunity of staying in many parts of the country. I am a writer, I am a poet, a playwright, a novelist. I've written 4 books in Sepedi, for which I've received several awards. For me, the journey with languages did not start as a conscious thing, it was just a given. I did not know any other language better than I did with my heritage language. So it's only when in 2011, when the PenSouth honored me with the PenSouth Multilingualism Award, where I started seeing a bigger picture. I started realizing that whatever I'm doing in my small space, in my artistic space, stands for this huge thing, which is the development of language. And since then, I consciously followed everything to do with that bigger picture, which linked me with, obviously, the reason behind it, because it's not just a language, it's the culture, the identity of the people, it's the history, it's the pride of the people. So I've done many things artistically, but throughout the consistent threat has been languages. I've been in the film industry, I've run the continent's largest industrial arts and creative industry center, that is Center for Creative Arts, among others. It runs the most popular Durban International Film Festival, the Poetry Africa, Time of the Writer. And throughout that journey, I've maintained that. I've also been part of the National Arts Council Board, being part of the National English Literature Museum Board, and luckily with the NAC, I've chaired the literature panel. The English Literature Museum has been important to me because one mistake that we do sometimes is we just argue for things and we fail to benchmark, to look and study the net and understand how the net is doing it, and that will inform the better method of how to do ours. So academically, I hold PhD in African languages, and I strongly believe I've been part of the Pencil board since 2011, because since then I've been following it throughout, and each time when the sad news of the dissolvement of the board comes, I was feeling like I'm part of that board which gets dissolved. And for me, it was more than just a board, because unfortunately, like it or not, Pencil elsewhere represents beyond just all languages, but particular languages. Thus, in deaf entities, we have the African Style Museum, we have the English literature, and we have nothing for the rest, meaning the only home for the rest becomes Pencil. And when Pencil fails, it is the failure of particular people. And that is, I believe, what helped me the most, what pushed me the most to say, yes, the history has not been good. Many other things that were not supposed to be done were done, and they need to be rectified, and someone, unfortunately, has to put their head on the block. And in this instance, I happen to be one of those that decided that I can do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I am now going to give an opportunity to honorable members to ask questions. As I said earlier, we don't take anything personal here. We ask questions because we want to understand, and there may be questions that we feel, that question, but we are asking it for honesty. You know, informed, because at the end of the day, for us to take a decision, we have to be informed.
Honorable member, honorable member.
Thank you.
Good morning, once again. I just want to follow up on the answer that you have just given. Just for interest's sake, you mentioned that you were once part of the NAP, and what is that on?
The Ministry of English Literature.
Okay. When is that?
It's the tenure that ended before the stock camp. So it started around 2014, I think it ended in 2017.
And that is for NAP?
No, for now. For NAP, it has been, I think it's 2015 to 2016.
So the new board at NAP replaced, you were part of the board that was replaced.
Dissolved. What were the challenges? Can you explain to us
in relation to the board that was dissolved?
The challenge that was brought to our attention, which we, it is so sad that we actually alluded it to the executive authority beforehand, because this was something that was looming outside. The procedure that was taken to appoint the board was testing, basically because the act stipulated that it should be an open interview. Members of the community, of the public, need to be invited and be part of it. DEC did not follow that. In the very first meeting of our induction, which is something which was recorded, it was brought to their attention, and they said nothing wrong with it. They followed what needed to be followed. And it took a year until people who were challenging it came out, and the executive authority came out to say this is the matter. But just in short, I think it's one of the challenges that the art and culture is facing. I mean, I've been following the proceeding that led to this interview. I've observed other entities within DAC, including the National Library Museum. We have a problem because we are unclear with our procedures in terms of appointing board, and at the end of the day, you even ask yourself if is it a delivery thing, because sometimes you can settle that maybe it becomes a delivery thing, so that if we do not want this board, then we can go back and use that as a way of just dissolving it, because perhaps there are other hidden agendas. But as far as I know, what was brought to our attention was procedurally that there did not follow the procedure.
Look, I heard that you have been following that since then, and I'm happy that you have got a qualification, a PhD in language. What other skills do you have if you happen to be appointed, given the challenge at the moment? You know, what other skills would go fuse to the board?
Thank you, I think the specific ones which we need to look at is in terms of formations of policies. And when I say policies, I'm not referring only to the 10,000 Act. The Act stipulates that part of 10,000 mandate is to advise the government in terms of legislation to do with language. The first thing, let's say the formulation of the 10,000 Board, require someone with business and acumen, because the running of NSAUD is not going to work out if there is no privatization. We need to ask those difficult questions. Can NSAUD continue having all the provincial offices, having managers in all provinces? You know, business-wise, do we have to continue with this stage where each year there is overspending, and even the running, the actual budget? I mean, you will have seen the study that was commissioned by the National Treasury, the Public Affairs Research Institute, which shows that 9% of the budget goes to the actual development of language. That is a problem. You know, in the historical chapter, we had situations where a lot of money goes to legal battles, a lot of money goes to management and corporate steps. We need a new model. We need to restructure and bow. We need to have a reproach to our priority. And I think that is what I have, which is critical to the future of PENFAO. But in terms of language, I mean, I have skills in interpretation, in translation. I have skills, including the financial side, because I've chaired the finance committee of NELM. I've been part of the audit and risk committee of NEC. I've had a bigger picture in terms of the quality, and I'll stress this one, because it's one thing to have the knowledge with the art, with the skill itself, but I think what is transpired in many boards is the qualities of the art that kills these boards, where people come with ulterior motives, where there are many strategies. I mean, I'm sorry to cite the practical one. I mean, I've been following this allegation that came in terms of the portfolio committees, and I'll tell you, those are some of the strategies that are being used in the art sector to silence people, where a person who is being seen as something wrong, there is an allegation that will come, and you will realize that it's a plain thing, because it will change shape. You know, one day you are accused of this, but other day you said. So I'm saying those are part of the skills that I have. I have a clear understanding. I have understanding of where it is the challenge, the penthouse challenge started, because it is mainly because of the fact that PennSouth, unlike other DAC entities, is a Schedule 1. So just from there, the interpretation has been wrong, because PennSouth viewed DAC as an ATM where they just get fiscal and come and report to the portfolio committee, and that created unnecessary commotion, because DAC said, look, we are the bosses also, you have to account to us because we give you money and we have to account. So as the reality of dealing with the whole situation facing PennSouth, one needs to sit down with executive office and authority and say, let's clean all the mess of the heat of the past before we start, because at the end of the day, if we don't do that, this board also will need to solve.
I've got an interest in the last part. That has been the problem. The issue of reporting. If you are appointed, how do you deal with this trial reporting to the portfolio committee and the DA? How are you going to manage it?
Thank you. I think it is just one thing. It's just the matter of how you view it, because the executive office comes with the entity to the portfolio committee. It makes sense for both the executive and the accounting authority to have a full picture before they come to the portfolio committee. And the fact that there is fiscal coming from the executive authority, there is that need of also accounting. But in that process, one needs to be clear of the power, that as long as the executive authority doesn't interfere with the actual decision taken by the accounting and the management, it's just a matter of knowing where the boundaries end. But the same message that should be brought to the portfolio is the message that needs to go to the executive. And for me, I won't see any challenge in that. It's just to respect all these platforms and know that they also, as the executive office, have to account to the portfolio.
But that's very much. That's love. And in a minute. Do you have any conflicting interest to set up?
No. If emotion can be regarded as conflict of interest, I think my love for it involved is just too much. But beyond that, I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Nakamel, welcome.
Thank you.
In your opening remarks, you said that you have been following the proceedings in PennSouth from 2011. Therefore, I'll assume that you understand very well that PennSouth has been established in the provisions, the founding provisions of our constitution. Now, can you explain your understanding of the mandate of the board as it relates to the Pan African Language Board Act of 1985 and the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa?
Thank you, and if I may, allow me to start in further from the MP3. And my reason being, it shows where we have lost our focus. If you look at the 93 PENSAL Act, it speculates and its approach has been so apologetic. It shows that the allowances which have been marginalized, that need to be developed and used equitably with other allowances. Now, when we move from there, and I'm still taking the question of the mandate of the board as in the accounting authority, but I'm talking the entity as a board, is the challenge now is when we move into the amendment, we change from the equitable outlook to equality outlook. When we want to treat all languages as the same, we want them to be respected equally, we want them to be used equally, but the element that we have left out, which was emphasized even without weight in the first act, is the need to develop. Because as much as long as the other languages are not developed enough, they will never be used equally as others. So you are saying something that will never happen. It's a mirage. You are saying someone with one leg should be in the same range with someone with two legs. English is by default a lingua franca, which is an opportunity. It gives it hegemonic status. The fact that the constitution which was signed by Nelson Mandela was the one in English on its own, it says something to other languages. And if you look at the conflicts that came from that process, particularly in terms of the Soto Salaboa versus the Fedi, came because of that. The original document is written, the Soto Salaboa, the translation says the Fedi, then the one which is signed by the president is the English version. That one's own says that other language, the original language, is not as important as this one being signed, because the final take is on this. So now with the actual job to be done, the actual is to promote, and I shy away from this word promote, because we use it randomly. We just go and make an event ceremonially and say we're promoting. I think we need to be from that mandate, we need to be specific and say we need to institutionalize our language to get a way where, and I'll give an example, English on its own is a doorkeeper for academia, for a black child to get educated. They have to deal with English first before they get the content. How do we get our languages to become doorkeepers elsewhere? And the best place, I think, because we can't challenge this one without resources, the best place is the wet area. How do we, and now that we have policies, we have the bill, the 2012 bill that allows us to say in each province at least three languages should be used. How do we get to a point where for me to get a particular job, I really need to be fluent in this language. And when I show you with the issue of the uneven ground, we are struggling with interpretation in the country. Look at the worst scenario was the failure of Nelson Mandela, where we had that sign language interpreter. So by default, choice of language is to expose yourself to any danger of being misinterpreted. I can, in a space like this, opt for debate, but will the interpretation be of high quality? Because we are still struggling in the country. So if I say in a regular space, because this is just a perfect platform where I should be expressing myself in my mother tongue, but should I have an interpreter who is not that good, now authentic and being misinterpreted. I'm disadvantaging myself by using that privilege. So it's not a privilege as it is. So in answering your question, the Constitution stipulates that, and my emphasis and interest is on the development sector. Before we can speak about other aspects, I mean, we have aspects such as languages used for religious purposes. And in our instances, when you look at it, we are so aloof. We talk about things, languages from elsewhere, as if even our local languages are not used for religious purposes. And I'll give you many examples in Venda, for instance. In Venda, I will say Bumanibu, because in that religion, that is the language of the religion. You have Motswana, who is in charismatic church. They will call themselves Motswana, because in that religion, the language which is used to define it is that, Musiomi, and so forth. So I'm saying the Constitution demands of us to do reflection in terms of our language. And obviously those researchers need to be available. We need to have them on public spaces like the website. We need to make sure that all languages are respected, are given the privilege they ought to have. We have another element, multilingualism, which is a problem because it's not defined. Multilingualism can mean just the coexistence of languages, but I think in our context it should mean the interaction of languages. I need to speak more languages. I need to be polyglottal to interact with people from other languages instead of just saying we have people in this room who speak 11 languages and we are multilingual.
You previously said that in the skills that you want to bring, if you have been appointed in the board, will be the formulation of policies, the prioritization of the board, and so on. You just alluded to the fact that multilingualism is not defined. Now, what is your sense of multilingualism? Why do you think it would be a good thing to practice multilingualism in both public sector and the private sector?
Thank you. One good man once said that the wealth of human experience is not found in one language. Each language has its own wealth, unique wealth, and it has the beauty that will enrich a person in a different way. Its culture, it comes with the entire identity of a person. Now, the challenge we have in the country, and with exception to few provinces, I'll name Limpopo and Gauteng, part of Mpumalanga, and maybe part of Northern Cape, where you have people who can strike conversation in two languages, you know, hearing and understanding each other, or even mixing languages. I mean, in Northern Cape, Afrikaans will be mixed with Setswana and Xhosa, and people will understand each other. And I think that is one element of multilingualism which is ignored, where people are able, in the Limpopo you have places like Elim, where Kunana Mtsonga, Unana Venda, and they can just change languages without even making it formal that, okay, now let's use this one. And that is the essence of our diversity as a country, which is ignored, which is not brought to the fore. We are only obsessed with just the coexistence. Let's just be in one room, all of us. And it's not translating to that social cohesion that we are looking for. Because the moment I'm with Mutsonga, Bilalukulu, and say, and the Muvesha, her perception changed. It's more like this is a secretive way that is known within the Batsonga, and if this Mubedi knows this way, then it's part of us. The reaction changes. So for me, I think we need, as Panther, we need to be the ones who give those distinct and precise definitions to the public, not be using all these used terms which are not clearly broken into pieces.
Can you understand that through an application in the board, know that there's a fruit of books have been? My question to you is, how will we ensure that there's always an ethical leadership and an integrity of the board? In your answer, can you please cover what is the fruit of ethics? And how will we bring this ethical code and conduct in terms of the board? And maybe give me three examples of
thank you. I think you have touched the very heart of every part of the country. If we are serious about making this country the way that has to follow us everywhere, ethical. Ethical is not just the doing of the act, it's the how. Is the who, the when, the everything. It speaks to the entire process. And I think the good thing is we, with ethical leadership, we rely on many legs. We have the King's Report, we have the public services. All these are trying to advise us towards one direction. Firstly, ethical leadership starts with self. Do you really interrogate, starting with the question that Dadana Kondo asked, why am I here? Am I the right person? Am I not completed? That's where it starts. Then it goes to the level of what is it that you're doing. I'll jump and go to another site where in other boards there was the whole thing of centering the editorial policy. The act itself, what you want to do, and something that you are mandated with the development of languages, but it is only 9% of your budget that goes to that mandate. Is it ethical? Are you sticking to what you are there to do? Then it goes to the how part. The how part is I might have to buy or purchase and something which is within the mandate. It has to be done. But the method that I will do, I will use, the people I will bring to box, maybe I have Makelwa Nwame who's doing the same service, and I got a gay Maki, come, there is a business opportunity. So for me, when we deal with ethical leadership, mainly they are summarized by these three elements, which is the who, meaning, if I'm on the board and I have all this political connection, and now my job is interfering with all those other things, or those other things are interfering with my job, it's problematic, because whatever decisions I will take, the act stipulates that there is a need of independence and impartiality in whatever decisions which are taken. So being conflicted, you are now unethical, because you are your decisions won't be as fair as they ought to be. The knowledge of the procedure, because if you are not you might be doing the right thing, but the how part, a good example that I will cite So the issue that you were dealing with of NAC, and there is an NAC issue where the board made a decision around the CEO. But the question is, what are, which is the key question is, which regulation did you follow? Because as a board, you don't just from your head decide and say, we are going to do this to the contract of the CEO and it ends there. You need to be governed by a particular policy. And in that act, in that instance, the what is not much question, but it's the how. Did you follow any procedure? What is all the act saying in guiding you towards that decision? So it's not just the decision that you take. So I think it's a very broader question, but it's very important, fundamental, because we can say all the lovely things that we want to do, but the actual implementation has to be grounded around ethical decision making.
And
my
second
question
is, my second question to you is, how will you deal with ethical
Thank you very much. It is a dual question answer kind of situation. It actually depends on the position that I'll be occupied. If I'm an ordinary member, it will obviously be advisory most of the time that fellow board members, the chairperson, whatever decisions which are taken or are brought to the table, if I feel something is unethical, I need to blow the whistle. I need to say, Chair, with due respect, did we follow this and this? Is this according to this and this? Aren't we exposing ourselves to this risk? Because the challenge with being in a board is that whatever decision that is taken, even if it's taken by the chair alone, it implicates all of you. So if you are dissolved, it's the entire board which is dissolved. But if, let's say for argument's sake, is the chairperson, and the first thing is to instill it in your fellow members, before you even take it to the management, you need to make sure that you make it clear within them, with you being the first example, in whatever you do, you become so independent. You know that it's not a one-man show. You open it to the rest, but you make it clear that every decision that is taken is taken with that outlook of, are we ethically conducting our act or our decision as the board, then as an entity, and obviously the entire sector.
Another
question, how would you integrate the conflict between the board and the executive office that you think has all the chemical cause and the toxicity? So, how are you going to implement? What is the root of the problem? Thank you. I think this is also one of the critical in terms of unnecessary commotion. The first responsibility that the board has is to know its margin, is to define what operational means and what strategic leadership means. Meaning, the first job that we have as a board is to interrogate the board charter. It doesn't matter what the previous board was viewing it, but we need to define it. We need to define our margin, and the board charter will advise us. We have to create it in such a way that it stipulates to the bone what operation means, what strategic leadership means. But in terms of leadership, as much as the management will be reporting to the board, and the board is not supposed to cross into the entity itself, in times of conflict, and the board needs to take parental role. Parental role for me is mostly limited to advisor, meaning if it comes to a push and there are all unnecessary commotions within the entity itself, the board can call a general meeting where the board can sit with the entire staff and management and say, guys, there are all these politics, but let's look at the bigger picture. At the end of the day, what is at stake is our languages, our identity, and all this. So we request that we go back to our offices, management, and staff. You go and sort this out. And we plead with the staff and management to, you know, put whatever aside you can and see the bigger picture. So you become a father or a mother rather than being the actual intervener as in heading head on. But if methods are worked where you need to really intervene, you need to know how to do it. That is why you will have to commission the third party, the independent investigation to get into the nitty-gritty, not you as the board ending up going into the entity, interviewing staff members, because that on its own is worsening the process. So I think it's much to do with that definition of roles. It needs to be clear, and you should know that the other part is for management, but you need to, from the distance, still keep your eye open, because you don't have to rely only on the reports that come to you, but you should know what is happening. So we said, if there is anything... I'm sorry to prolong it, but this is the danger of passion sometimes.
Thank you very much. You can switch off your mic. As we indicated earlier, this country is going to be recorded for 5 minutes.